Good.
All's good.
Welcome, everyone.
Hi, Ken.
Thanks. Hey, Ken.
Greetings from Washington, D.C., where we're locked down to for who knows until when.
In Philly, I'm on my roof deck because we have the Blue Angels flying over at 2 o'clock, which is like the highlight of my month, some form of live entertainment. So, oh, wow. I'm on my roof deck waiting.
So that's what. So that's why you're in sunglasses.
It is.
No, her future's so bright, she's got to wear shades.
I know, you can see Philly. See Philly? My skyline?
Oh, yeah.
Nice
day to be outside.
Yeah.
It's gloomy here still.
I think we have 39 on right now. I'll give it another 30 seconds or so, and we'll kick it off. So I mentioned that Joel Wood, Joel Coppard, and Blair Bartlett from the government affairs team will be joining us. Joel had a conflict come at 1 o'clock, so he'll be joining us in between our two discussion topics. So he said he'll ping me, and we might shift the conversation towards all things government affairs around 1:20, and then we'll try to kick it back to that second topic on post-pandemic back-to-work plans. Another couple of things, the chat is available for everyone to see. So if it's a minor comment, a question you have, or a comment, feel free to post in the chat box. It's at the bottom of your screen. Additionally, if you'd like to talk, I know there can, you know, we have 40 or so voices. If there's a lot of stuff going on, what you can do is either go on video and raise your hand, or if you go to the participants at the bottom again, it will, you can see a couple icons and there's a hand signal. My colleague Maureen Lilienthal, who is on our Leadership Academy and does a lot of the programs you're familiar with, Broker Smackdown, other virtual leadership trainings, is on the line as well. I'll let her introduce herself, but she will be sorting through comments, looking for trends and themes. And so we can always circle back at the end of the meeting on anything we might want to get back to. And if this is a successful meeting, we can certainly come back to themes from this in future meetings as well. Another thing, this will be recorded for internal purposes only. We won't be distributed outside of the working group. And just a reminder that this meeting will adhere to the council's antitrust policy. Maureen, would you like to introduce yourself, and then we'll get started.
Hi, everyone. Nice to meet you all. I look forward to helping Rob out in terms of facilitating the chat and discussion. If you have any problems at all from a technical standpoint, please also use that chat box. For those of you who are on the phone, we obviously can't see you on video, and you can't use the raised hand icon if you're just listening on the telephone. So if you would like to speak and join a discussion, just tell us who you are before you start speaking. Thanks, Rob, and I look forward to working with all of you during the course of the meeting.
Great, thanks, Maureen. And for those who have not joined the group in person, my name is Rob Boyce. I'm a director on the Market Intelligence and Insights team and have been running this group for, I want to say, 4 or so years now. It's one of the younger working groups. I think it's about 6 years old. And we've really seen some meaningful change as the group has been able to collaborate face-to-face over, 6 or so years. So it's been really great to watch this group grow. I'd like to introduce Michael Rivas, who's been our working group chair for the past 18 months to 2 years, as well as Henry Wright, if he is online. He's our upcoming chair from McGriff. Michael is with Assurance in Chicago. Michael?
Yeah, so first off, I just want to thank everybody for coming together. I know this group always comes up with some great ideas and looks at things from new and interesting perspectives. So much like all of our other meetings, I encourage everybody to be open and vocal in things that you're experiencing or seeing out there in the industry. I know these are some new challenging times. Actually, I told Rob, I said, before I give up my chair position in October, I'd like to sneak in a couple extra meetings. And so he came up with this idea, and I said, yeah, what the hell? I know Henry and I and Rob got together a couple weeks ago, and we put together some ideas that we thought at least we were hearing a lot of right now during this COVID crisis. I think I'll give a chance for Henry to introduce himself, but then after that, I think we want to open up with a survey real quick to kind of see which direction the collective group wants to head in the conversation. All right, Henry? Is Henry on? All right. I'm going to kick it back to...
He's on. He might be on mute.
All right. So, all right. We'll let Henry introduce himself at the end. Let's go ahead and move to the poll, and we'll hear a couple questions. Right.
And if the answer for question one is yes or no, but expect to, feel free to elaborate on that in the chat, on the line of business, the type of client, if that's something you're comfortable sharing.
And then, Rob, you're aggregating the survey results, correct?
Yes, I will. We will be providing a recap, which is why we are recording this, with the polling numbers and several key themes throughout the meeting, and always welcome you to come back with other themes or topics you'd like to discuss in future meetings. But we'll use some of the results and conversation topics from this meeting to help help structure future meetings as well.
Okay.
Hi, Rob and Michael. This is Henry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you, Henry.
Loud and clear.
Okay. You don't have to wait until the end now to introduce me. I'm sorry. It's the dreaded mute. I just got in. So I apologize for not figuring out the technical difficulties. But just like Michael and Rob said, I'm so glad that we're having this meeting. I know everyone, this pandemic has really been a different environment for most people working from home and dealing with all the issues at work and family, and not to mention our business and economy has just been disrupted. So I appreciate everyone taking the time out of their busy schedules to participate in this meeting. And although virtually, I think it's going to be very productive, and I'm happy to be a part of it.
Thanks so much, Henry. Michael, can you confirm that you see the results on the screen?
I do see the results, and it's kind of interesting. I think the very first question is, have we been successful in getting COVID-related coverages for the clients? And that's a very broad term, and I know that COVID is hitting multiple lines of insurance. A vast majority of 58% of you said no. 16% of you did say yes. There was another 16% that said not yet, right? No, but we expect to. So if we could not discuss the BI coverage at this point, because that was question number two, but just maybe some of the other lines of coverage that we're looking at. Perhaps it's, I would assume it's probably focused more around workers' comp. Does anybody want to talk about where they've been successful with getting coverage on the comp side or any other lines? And then, like I said, we'll discuss BI as a separate topic.
Mike, we do have a few comments that were typed in. The first is that several hospital clients on manuscript policies have communicable disease coverage. And another comment that they were able to obtain coverage for event cancellation.
All right, so whoever mentioned the event cancellation, mm-hmm. I think is that I see Steinmiller. I forget the first name.
It's me. It's Heather.
Thanks, Heather. Heather, thanks. Would you? I've seen some of the coverages.
Yeah, so I think it's a unique coverage, but I think that's where a lot of clients are hearing about Wimbledon, because that was a headline, right, that Wimbledon got $148 million for the event. So there's been a lot of discussions. Event cancellation coverage doesn't seem to have the same exclusions that a property, because it's a much more narrow coverage grant. I mean, it's a coverage grant for the event itself, and it doesn't matter what canceled the event. So I think in the hospitality industry, when our clients have had large venues or they've been dependent on events, there was some coverage available for event cancellation that affected the hotels, which was broader than what we're seeing under the normal property policy, if you will.
Okay. So I have seen some event coverages that exclude pandemics.
Okay, yeah, I haven't, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Is everybody else seeing success under the event coverage?
We've had a couple of clients that have coverage through Philadelphia, and they've received a denial on the property damage, but they've got a Bell endorsement that's on their package policy that includes like conference cancellation. It's small sublimits, but it at least gives some of the smaller nonprofit clients at least some return for money that they've expended out. But it's under their Bell endorsement.
Thank you. On the workers' comp, I was going under this premise that if you're a first responder or a healthcare worker and you tested positive for COVID, that it was probably very likely that this would be covered under comp. But I've been getting some mixed responses from the carriers. But has anybody else had experience working with the first responders or the healthcare workforce and how the carriers are responding?
Michael, this is Derek. I just threw that in the chat as well. I'm getting mixed responses. I think in some cases they're legit. You know, they're saying there's a lack of medical, you know, records, but the employees are working for a healthcare facility. The healthcare facility has had confirmed COVID-19 cases, and you're just scratching your head a little bit. So we're kind of knee deep in that right now. I expect that to evolve a bit and then, not get state specific, but I think, you know, some of the states are making this real complicated right now and confusing for the clients.
We've had some issues with mixed results, in particular with travelers, to be honest with you. They, from office to office, it seems, we have a big rehab operation that operates in 11 states. And they, in some states, they're saying, okay, if the worker that came down with COVID-19, you can show that they had exposure to one of the patients at the rehab facility who had COVID-19. They're accepting that. In other states, they're going through this, well, give us a list of everybody you've been in contact with in the last 2 weeks, and we want to know whether any of them have COVID-19. And it's just, as you can imagine, in a rehab facility, which is a nice word for a nursing home, you know, they're getting hit very hard. And so we're seeing a lot of people that are coming down with the COVID-19, and the lack of consistency is driving the insured crazy, to be honest.
No, I completely agree. I think they were seeing a lot of that. And let's see.
I'm starting to see where some of the COVID cases have been denied, and then it's turning to a anxiety type claim, especially with nursing homes that have, you know, a significant number of cases within the facility.
Yeah, this is Jim.
Yeah, Jim. Thank you.
Yep.
Hey. We're seeing some of our carriers, what they're doing is do what they call contact tracing. And for example, there was one employee that came in, and this is it's a residential home for undocumented kids. And somebody brought it in from it was community spread, but everybody who caught it from that individual from the community spread, they did what they call contact tracing. How much exposure did they have to that employee, you know, close proximity. And then, so we saw where they accepted three of the claims and then denied three of the others as not in the course and scope. So Texas Mutual is probably the largest workers' comp carrier in Texas. And what they're doing is they're doing all of this via a panel. So they're bringing in their medical doctors, their attorneys, and the adjusters, and the round table in it to make a consistent decision to avoid, one adjuster handling something one way and another adjuster handling it another way, but they're trying to kind of trace, you know, where the source came from and was it work related. So that's what we're seeing with some of the carriers. Some of them are just flat out denying it, and then, you know, they're going to have to go through an appeal process.
Is anybody else seeing carriers respond with this contact tracing? No, it's just Texas? Okay, good to know.
Hey, we're the Lone Star State.
There you go.
I'm sorry, I was on mute. That's what Travelers is doing in some of their states. That's what it was, that inconsistency that I was talking about. They're doing the contact tracing. In some of the states and in others, they're accepting it if they can just show they worked on a patient that was a COVID patient.
And then, is anybody else running, or I know we're running into it, so just any other experiences where people are running into carriers that are just blanketly denying the claim and saying, hey, you know, you can fight this later, or?
Definitely. This is Lisa with Heffernan. In California, the larger carriers are, unless there is an absolute, like they were caring for a patient that was positively diagnosed with it, they're doing a blanket.
Lisa, we lost you.
Sorry. In California especially, I see most of the large carriers issuing a denial and then working backwards. So it's automatically a denial, and then they work backwards to protect, you know, their investigative approach. But I don't mean to jump ahead, but I do want to say this really quickly. What I'm seeing more than anything, again, in California and actually the West Coast, is psychiatric claims filed. And that are turning into EPLI claims and issues like that. So if that's not something that we have tabled to talk about, I thought I'd throw that out there to see if that's anybody else's experience.
And so Lisa, that isn't one of our the questions that we had on this agenda, but I'm more than happy to discuss it if the group would like to talk about some of those psych claims. Does anybody want to unmute themselves and talk about it?
I have a question on those psych claims in the EPL. I haven't seen any, you know, every day it's something new, but I haven't seen any carriers having an exclusion on the EPL policy that would be COVID related, right? Like there's like virus exclusions popping up on the GL, and there's talk about them doing it prospectively for the EPL and the executive risk. But to date, has anybody seen an exclusion on an EPL policy that those claims would not be covered by unemployment practices?
I think it depends upon the actual allegation. Because the allegations that we're getting is, so for example, there's labor law under a pandemic that you can require people to tell you why they were out sick. You can take temperatures. But if they have a negative test, you can't say a word to anybody. And so what's happening is people are finding out through the grapevine that somebody was exposed, but they had a negative test. It's being pinned on the employer that the employer leaked it out. And so then it's turning into, you know, basically they violated their rights because they had this, they're filing a site claim. And I've seen at least five of these within the last 20 days.
But have you seen a carrier for your employment practices? I guess what I'm asking is, I know the allegations dictate coverage, but I haven't seen an employment practices policy that outright excludes COVID-19 claims like you see on a property claim that has the virus exclusion. I have not seen that. Obviously, for an EPL, you have to have allegations that trigger coverage, but I haven't seen an exclusion on EPL policies that would exclude coverage. Have you?
I have not.
Okay.
Okay. So for
can I just add one more thing on the workers' comp to keep in mind that we found out about that I think might be helpful? If you have an employer has a large self-insured workers' comp, some of your excess policies may make all your comp claims one occurrence. So if you have like a $2 million retention on your comp policy, there are endorsements that sort of combine all of them to make them one claim, even though they're separate comps. I don't know if anybody's run into that yet.
Yeah, we've seen that on our hospital accounts, which are large self-insured.
Yeah.
We also. So we've seen that with our clients that our hospital or have $2 million SIRs and then the excess carrier. We definitely have that being treated as one occurrence under the.
So we had a carrier who came back and said it's too early to tell whether it's the same strand and one occurrence, which I thought was an interesting response by the carrier.
That is interesting. No, we conference called with Arch and went over even the documentation. This particular client happens to self-administer their claims. So we wanted to make sure, you know, what documentation was going to be required. And we set up a process for communicating new event. I don't want to say new cases, but new claims under the same occurrence. You know? But they are treating it as one occurrence and did not mention anything about any particular strain of the virus. Now I'm a little concerned. Maybe I need to go back and just double check. So
That came in today, and it was concerning for me.
Yeah, definitely.
Like even when you think you have coverage, something else comes up on these things.
Hi, this is Gwen. From JGS Insurance. So we have a large social service account, and there seemed to have been an outbreak at one of their locations. And initially, the client did not want to report any of these COVID-related claims to their workers' comp carrier, and because they just didn't think that it was a workers' comp issue. But the carrier asked them to report it, and they wanted to do a formal investigation. So finally, they did end up reporting it, but the client did not want the carrier to contact the individual employees. So I'm curious to know if how you have been handling it with regards to your clients, where they've given you like pushback, not for the carrier to contact the employees to do the investigation. Because we've run into that a few times now with many of our clients.
Does anybody have any feedback on that? No?
All right. Well, yeah. This is always something that we can circle back to, even if it's on this call or maybe push it to a later time. I do see the entire government affairs team online. For those that have not seen him in person or through our daily evening emails, Joel Wood, Joel Copwood, and Blair Bartlett are on the line. Joel Wood has been with the council for something, you know, over 34 years, I believe. So he's just about seen it all, and he's very well connected in that space. So I wanted them to just hop on and provide a brief overview and maybe answer some questions around, you know, what you've been reading and what we're expecting to see. So I welcome the three of you to hop on. I believe I saw you online. Can you just let us know you're on?
Thanks, Joel. For any one of your youth, I'm sure it seems like 34 years that I've been here. It is 27, however. I've been in town for about 35 years or so, and forgive the dog in the background. So the thing that honestly that worries me the most is what Jen Weathersby just sent to everybody, that the State Fund just announced that they're going to accept any claim by an essential worker. And so Newsom's executive order was out. I guess my question to you, Jen, or Lisa, if you know, or anybody else from California, is what we were understanding weekend before last as Zenith Insurance and others were melting down over what the executive order was going to be, was that it would not only be for essential workers, as we've seen in four or five jurisdictions and legislation in about 11 jurisdictions, but that it would apply to all. So I'm assuming this is a news flash, and I just don't know any other details. If you do, I'd love to hear it now.
Hey, Joel, it's Jen. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I just shot a little thing over there. This has been consuming my everyday for the past week because I think once Zenith had a little bit of a meltdown, I think on the heels of AB664 being launched in California, introduced. I know they don't come back into session until May 4th. There is rumor that Newsom is considering an executive order that would make a conclusive presumption for all essential workers. It would also, you know, include stress claims, quarantine. It would not predicate a positive test for COVID, and any treating physician of any specialty could make the diagnosis. What I'm hearing just from a whole bunch of people that I talked to, and I don't know, Lisa, if you've heard as well, is that this was drafted based on a request from a lot of labor organizations by the California Applicants Attorneys Association to Governor Newsom. They talked about doing that back on March 19th. I think it finally made its way there, although no one's really seen it. I'm sure somebody's seen it, but the public hasn't really seen it. And then, of course, the grassroots opposition that was launched by Zenith and a lot of the agricultural associations to oppose any potential executive order triggered a whole bunch of panic last week, thinking that something was already done when I don't think it's been done yet. My supposition with the state fund, that announcement came out Friday. My guess is they're somewhat quasi-state, that maybe this was a way for them to offer some sort of compromise or preempt any potential executive order, because it does actually contemplate a positive test, even though it doesn't necessarily contemplate that it had to occur in the course and scope of work. And it is for any essential worker, which for California right now, that's defined as anybody in the critical infrastructure segment. So it isn't just healthcare workers and frontline workers. So I'm wondering if they just did that to preempt any potential executive order as a way to thwart it and control it. AB 664 has a little bit more, you know, meat to it. It is only for healthcare workers and frontline folks, but, you know, definitely I feel like California is just kind of carving its own path.
Yes, you are. Thanks for the elaboration.
Can I come work somewhere else? Anybody else have an opening?
So let me just, it's been interesting to hear the conversation so far, and let me just try to give you a couple of minutes of sort of where we are and allow Joel and Blair to weigh in. You know, the other Joel attends all the little liberal seances on your behalf, and I've been in a couple of the right-wing ones in the last hour or so. I tell you, the one that was a little depressing, it was with a pretty conservative member. He's normally pretty sane, but one of the lobbyists started talking about how we've got to open up the economy, we can't wait on a vaccine, that we've all got to get herd immunity. And as somebody who's the father of a kid whose immune system is extremely compromised, that ain't exactly a solution that I enjoyed hearing about. But then was just on with Steve Stivers, who's the ranking Republican on the Insurance Subcommittee of Financial Services, really smart on all this. I view all of this as and Heather's heard my ritual on this several times, is essentially three waves over the last, 6-7 weeks. I lose time. And I hope you're all getting the newsletter every day, and I hope that it's helpful to you and your colleagues. And it's sort of our sort of day in, day out stream of consciousness of stuff that we think that's interesting. And certainly I have to change my story on almost a daily basis with different political circumstances. But the first tranche of this was, you know, all of the retrospective imposition of BI coverage, both at the state level and two or three, half-assed attempts, largely by Democrats, but with a couple of Republicans involved in the House of Representatives. And I'd like to think that because we've got a good profile, we were able to slap a lot of that down. And I think a lot of people overreact when they see a bill introduced in a state house. You know, it's a very populist position to take. Frankly, it's the position that the president of the United States took when he stepped up to the microphone Friday before last at 2 o'clock and was asked You know, do you think the credit card companies are doing enough to forbear debt? And his response was, no, I think the insurance industry is screwing everybody on BI claims. Now, he, you know, it's a populist position, and he's speaking as a hotelier when he did that. But we've had these challenges, but I think that that's largely over with. Heather may want to disagree with me because her firm is headquartered out of New Jersey, whereas that's the only place where a retrospective imposition of BI coverage and property passed out of a committee, but I don't even see evidence that that's going to happen. Second thing that we're spending, you know, 80% of our time on is trying to work, given all of the holes in the CARES package. We see the wild success of and the wild dysfunction of the PPP. And, you know, I saw Brian Moynihan of Bank of America over the weekend predicted that it'll run out of money within, you know, 72 hours or so, the latest $310 billion infusion into that. So then that leaves the question, well, what next? It was structured as an entitlement program. And so you're going to have, and what Joel is hearing is rage from his Democratic friends over undeserving businesses, unsympathetic businesses, big businesses, Ruth's Chris, all of those examples. Republicans, meanwhile, are saying we just got to stop printing money. How does this all come together? Democrats demanding McConnell get on board with aid to state and municipalities. McConnell last night recognizing that the PPP is going to run out of money, dangling the prospect of state aid, but only with a liability shield, and mixed messages already from Democrats, though I think that they're going to stick with the plaintiff's bar on this and are not going to go along with that. How about all that plays out? What role can we play in the launch of a policyholder and insurance industry a collaborative effort to create a business continuation and recovery fund modeled after the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund? We've made a lot of progress on that. I think you're going to see a lot of noise on that. And then in the coming days, the question is, will there be a very significant CARES package 2.0 or phase 4 of it? That's the second piece. The third piece, there's been a lot more, honestly, I think there's been a lot more talk and political activity than is called for on the notion of prospective pandemic reforms moving forward. Now, our association, our board, has really leaned in. Unlike all of my colleagues on the carrier side, I've been with about 30 of them in the last hour, who are, you know, iron wall of resistance to the notion of any balance sheet risk, any skin in the game, talking about total lack of bandwidth, et cetera. Meanwhile, I've been the skunk at the garden party on, you know, our member firms wanting to lean in, wanting to be on the field, all the major loss adjusting firms wanting to be a part of the solution going forward beyond COVID. But we really are talking, if, you know, when people think about prospective risk, you know, we're not talking about when COVID reappears in October because the house is already on fire. We're talking about pandemic risk and utilization of existing insurance mechanisms of which we can be a part of the solution, not the solution, moving forward beyond that. So we're having this sort of rushed up 30-day, you know, three-month sprint. But I really think that this is more like a 2 to 3 year effort. And it is just not top of mind to me right now because it took 14 months for Congress after 9/11 to erect the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act. And so we have to envision a world beyond COVID. We want to be a part of that solution, but I think that that's largely, forgive me, but it's, I think that's a lot of noise right now. So we're just trying to stay focused on what are the things that we can do for liquidity of our member firms. So with, forgive that ramble, Joel, I will mute myself with this phone call coming in. I'll let you have the table.
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it. It's all about, you know, it's all about keeping your clients their head above water. So it's, to Joel's point, it's all about liquidity, but there's a big, you know, there's a second issue here, that tranche that we're dealing with that we're not hearing, to be honest, a lot of noise from our members on, but it's pretty significant, which is how all of this is going to impact the future of employer-sponsored insurance and employee benefits. We're part of a coalition with, you know, large employer groups, other insurers, AHIP, the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, the unions, focused primarily on just making sure that employees, people who get furloughed, who get laid off, can still stay on their plans. But the numbers, and I don't know if you've seen this in Joel's emails, and we'll push this out again, but the numbers, that tie high unemployment rates to the risk pools for insurers is staggering. If we reach 20% unemployment, 30% unemployment, you think about all those employees that are going to be ripped off of their plans. What does that mean, not just for their coverage, but also for the coverage of employees that are still on their plans? And what does that mean for their premiums? They're going to skyrocket. So to that end, we are locked in arms with the carriers on this, and our number one priority is lobbying for 100% COBRA subsidies, just for the short term. That's the short-term solution. There's a lot of long-term issues that we're dealing with, but right now it's just asking the federal government to 100% cover people's COBRA subsidies in this short-term period. I've been told that, it is included in the Speaker Pelosi's next phase four, CARES 3.0, 3.5, whatever you want to call it, the next bailout package. They do include COBRA subsidies. The level is unclear. The Biden campaign is pressuring Congress to do 100% subsidies. But the big issue with this is the Hyde Amendment language that says federal funds cannot be used for abortion services. It's a major sticking point in the Senate, particularly with Chairman Alexander and the Help Committee. I was on a call with White House legislative staff the other day, and they said this is a real sticking point. If we can't figure out how to work around Hyde language, there ain't going to be no COBRA subsidies for anybody. They support COBRA subsidies, but we got to figure out how we can thread the needle on this Hyde stuff. So that's a major, major sticking point. So COBRA is number one, and close number two is looking for premium assistance to employers who are having to scale back their operations or who are considering scaling back their benefit programs. If we can get the federal government to subsidize their contributions to employee-sponsored insurance, that'd be great also. But our number one priority right now is COBRA. I was told, so AHIP, the carriers, have asked for The carriers are asking for really five issues in the next bailout package. Number one is COBRA subsidies. The second is employer subsidies. The third is expansion of HSAs. I don't think that's likely to make it in there. The fourth is special enrollment for those trying to enroll in the ACA marketplaces. And the fifth priority for theirs is an increase of subsidy eligibility for Obamacare exchange policies. I think most of those will make it in. I think the HSA priority probably will have the most angst, or probably be met with, won't be as well received within the Democratic caucus, but we'll see. But this is a major issue. All of the noise that we're hearing from our CEOs, understandably so, is all on liquidity and helping their clients stay above water. But number two, the real implications for employer-sponsored insurance is significant. And, this is all going to play in. We can talk about the politics on this later, but this is going to play into what happens when if the White House flips, if the Senate flips. Before going into this, it's all about Medicare for All and public option, and what are the parameters of that look like. In this environment, those parameters are going to expand significantly, and I think the threat to ESI is really upside down right now. So I just want you all to know that we are watching it, we're engaged, we're pushing for all of this. If you guys have any feedback on this, let me know.
Hey, Joel. This isn't healthcare related, but I agree with you guys on the wave. It seems like the next wave of questions we're getting from the client is on the general liability side, because what we're seeing is a lot of general liability policies have pollution excludes that include the word virus, and so carriers are citing that for exclusion for claims. Clients, as they start to reopen their establishment, are really focused on the immunities that have been talked about. So I know that the White House sort of suggested that they were working on some sort of immunity. I don't know how they can do that at the federal level, but what are you guys hearing on the immunity discussion? I know you touched on it on your newsletter today, but that seems to be the next pressure point for our customers.
And I know that we're going to talk about that on the broader legal counsel's meeting later today, and you're the first that raised it to me, and I'm sure I should have been hearing more about it previously. What I'm venturing this to be, we're going to have a ton of noise on the liability stuff. I found it interesting that Joel Kay gets a note from a well-positioned Democratic insider this morning, giving all of their sort of 20 talking points of what they intend to do in the next package, one of which was thoroughly reject anything that McConnell, in terms of a liability shield, or the administration would want. But then an hour after that, Steny Hoyer, who's the moderate in the leadership, puts out a tweet that they have yet to give consideration to the liability-related issues, so stay tuned on that. It is my belief that there may be more, they did just for face mask manufacturers and very frontline responders in one of the early bills, they may be able to expand around the edges in critical infrastructure, but the kind of broad stuff that McConnell's talking about, no way, no how, not in Nancy Pelosi's House of Representatives. What I think that this means then is that the competition is going to be on among the states as to who has the most regressive and the most progressive, business continuation plans with respect to addressing liability issues that I think otherwise could seize up a big portion of the economy. That's a non-answer, but I don't see a major federal preemption on it.
Thanks. That was helpful, actually. I mean, just that information alone, if our customers are asking now as they start to reopen malls, shopping centers, hotels, they want to know if they have any immunity because it's in the newspaper a lot, is this whole push for immunity. And my response has been that I don't think it's going to go anywhere, but your sense is much.
So, you know, I think it's interesting. The president just said that he's going to issue an executive order for special liabilities for Tyson for the meat, for the poultry industry. Obviously, you know, there's a potential food crisis around the corner that he's dealing with, but I feel like that's probably the canary in the coal mine on liability protections. But I could be wrong.
That may be right. And there's not a lot of details on exactly what, in the present, not shockingly, didn't seem to really understand what it was. We shall see. Because he was asked, are you doing this because of the supply chain issues? He's like, there's plenty of supply. Why are you doing it?
Plenty of food. Rob, if there's no more questions, we'll turn it back to you.
Yeah, that was super helpful. I really appreciate you guys coming in. And if you have any questions after or want to put it through the chat box, I'm happy to connect you with our government affairs team or point you in the right direction. I know we are working on a couple resources. Gracie on our government affairs team is working on kind of a back to work best practices something, and we will be having some webinars coming up. So I think we're trying to kind of pivot and start looking forward now instead of being more reactive, which I think was our initial instinct. But if there are no questions, again, I appreciate it, and I'm happy to connect you with the government affairs team offline.
Yeah, just want to thank everybody. Thank you, Rob, for having us. Jen, especially for the elaboration on California. I get super paranoid whenever I hear the word California these days. So to all of you, just as I noted, just keep good stuff coming our way. I'm so appreciative for all that you do. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Rob, do we have another survey question? I know we were going to try and transition a little bit to opening up again.
Yes, we do. I'm putting it up right now. Poll number two. Okay, so the question is, has your firm, so this goes back to the more forward-looking back to work, has your firm internally started working on a post-pandemic strategy? We'd love to hear some expanded thoughts on that, kind of where you are and what you're keeping in mind. And the second is, are you currently working with your clients in this capacity? Again, you can expand if this is your team or different departments, but I think it'll be helpful to get a time frame and kind of how you're communicating it, because obviously it can be a tricky situation.
While you're all answering that question, this is Ken Carrar. I just wanted to say that we've launched already. You should have seen a couple webinars regarding sort of a back to work, and we'll be launching a full back to work series starting really next week. This week, there is one session tomorrow that begins at noon that has the investment. One of the lead investment officers at, who is it? It's Merrill Lynch. It's our investment firm. It's the big one. And they've done really well. And he's going to talk about the signposts, the guideposts that you need to watch for as we go forward. And I've heard the presentation or part of the presentation once, and it's really compelling. These are 30-minute calls generally, So it's meant to get in, get out. We did one last week on Friday for producers and client-facing people, how to talk to your clients in a difficult situation, and it was really well received. We've never had webinars where we've invited everybody and we've gotten 2,500 people sign up, but that's the kind of volume that we're seeing. So we're really, and this group, as Rob and I have talked, we hope that we'll bring this group together once a week for a while, just to give you a place to come to sort of get some information and to share a peer-to-peer support. So I thank you for all your hard work, because you're the core of the service model of this industry, and we're really proud that you're part of our team. So thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Ken. And just expanding on that, if you're not part of our Basecamp group or you think the invitation email may have gotten stuck in junk, reach out to me after this meeting. I do post the recordings as well as the registration links for all of our webinars, which, as Ken said, have been getting some really solid feedback. I'll go ahead and end this poll. Looks like the majority of respondents, 70%, say their firm has started working on a post-pandemic strategy. And then client-facing, again, 67% of respondents said they are working with their clients in this capacity. I think that's a solid number. I welcome you to elaborate. Go ahead.
Rob, one of the things I said no on, are we working with our clients? We have an in-house attorney, and they were very concerned about any advice that we would be giving to our clients coming back on an E&O situation against us. So our in-house, you know, we want to do it, and he's even proposed drawing up some type of document that would hold us harmless. But it does open the door, I believe, to a serious E&O situation, and one that may not even be covered by your E&O policy, because your insurance agent, you're not out there to give instructions on how to reopen after a pandemic. And is that really, or is somebody going to come back and say that that's outside of the scope of being an insurance agent on the E&O coverage? Just something to think about.
I've definitely seen that. That's a hot conversation topic, you know, when reading a lot of the concerns out there. And then looks like the majority of people. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that's one of the reasons that what we'll be issuing shortly, that Gracie's working on, is a best practices. We're doing it as a best practices, and it will be a live document that will be posted so that you can add to it. But it's things that you can pull from to assist your clients with. So it has a slightly different. It'll be a collective aggregation of that kind of information, which I think should give you a little bit of cover.
Yeah, we really
an attorney. So thank God
we appreciate that. We've actually seen just in the last 3 to 4 days an uptick in questions that have come our way about getting back to work and reopening the workplaces, and so we've seen several maybe providers or others in the industry that have, such as like the ServPros, the Service Masters, and right. They provided some good documentation. But if you guys have something as well, we've built our resource center here at True North as well, which links to a lot of the same information. But if we're also linking to the CIAB website, which has been right. Helpful. So thank right. You.
Well, thanks.
So 67% of you said you're helping your clients with returning to work. So I guess for those of you who are engaged with your clients directly on that, what are some challenges that you're running into, or what are some strategies you found that have been helpful? I appreciate the linking to the CIB. I think that makes a lot of sense. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, actually, this coming Friday, because our governor made an announcement yesterday, saying that he's going to open up restaurants, movie theaters, retail stores this Friday. So this Friday, we're actually having a webinar for our clients, and we're just going to outline all of the requirements set out by the governor through the executive orders, you know, to kind of, you know, and refer back to the state documents to try to minimize, you know, liability, saying, okay, hey, they said you can open. And for example, like gyms, bars, nail salons, beauty shops can't open yet. And so if you have a restaurant and 51% of the sales are alcohol sales, they can't open yet. So we're going to cover all of the little nuances there. And then in the executive order set out by the governor, it says, you know, no silverware on the tables, no single, no mass condiments, no ketchup, no mustard, no salt, no pepper, everything. So we're going to bring this out to the clients and make them aware that it's like, hey, if you're going to open, you have to have a plan to open and make sure you cover and make sure you're in compliant, because you can be in violation. And they're only allowing 25%. And if they don't see any increases in COVID cases, because they're going to do some tracing, then hypothetically, May 18th, they're going to allow 50%. So if this kind of holds true, we don't see Texas probably opening back up until first part of June, mid-June, to normal occupancy. So that's what we're doing. And we're putting stuff on our website, linking it to y'all's website, plus the CDC, plus the state's website as well. So all we're doing is bringing information from the professionals and then just bringing it in a easier to read format, and then giving them the resources necessary so they can make an informed decision to open up safely.
It is, thanks a lot, Jim. Is anyone on this call from Georgia by any chance? Well, I guess, well, they're probably really busy anyway. Is anybody else helping their clients, putting out, I guess, policies, procedures, or suggestions, or is it just, I shouldn't say, is it just, or are we interpreting some of the, you know, government entities' outlines or regulations, just explaining that this is how we interpret it? What's everybody else's strategy around this?
Hey, Michael, it's Bernadette. I think I probably answered the poll questions wrong because I really was thinking from a claims perspective, but organizationally, we have done quite a bit. So we have had some loss control, shared loss control for property and casualty presentations for our clients. I think we had about 1,000 attendees. It was very highly attended. From the property perspective, you know, what to be looking for when you're restarting operations and checking your equipment and your sprinklers and all that kind of stuff. And then casualty, of course, you know, talked a lot about, you know, that side of the house. And then also we had an employee benefits person on that same conversation. And we have the microsite that we're tracking all of the STEPTOE and the council's, you know, findings and having that all linked together. So I think we're doing some of those same things. But I was really thinking from a claims perspective, what our overall post-pandemic, post-return-to-work strategy is going to look like. So that's... You should probably put me in the yes categories then, I guess.
All right. Thanks for that. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Tim with M&T. So we have just started doing individual meetings with some of our larger clients, you know, from New York. So the governor has already started talking about reopening parts of the state, and where we've been afraid to put out white papers on the topics because you know, the regulations have been changing, and the things that Governor Cuomo might want to see when a business reopens could be different tomorrow. So we've been having basically 1-hour meetings with some of our larger clients in a team fashion to kick around controls that they can put in place. And we do try to bucket them in the, you know, the administrative, the engineering, and the PPE, you know, and PPE sections. You know, talking about who should be there, travels, break rooms, the whole nine, things that the customer can think about and to kind of develop best practices, you know, on their own with our guidance. And everything cleaning related, we tie right back to really the CDC because they're the experts in it. We don't want to, you know, mislead them there. But as far as the policies and procedures go, we've been having, you know, meetings. So they seem to be going really well.
Yeah. And then I think we have time for maybe one more comment regarding helping our clients open up again, or strategies you're doing internally as a firm. If anybody would like to have the last word on this.
I have one question. We did this last Friday on a webinar. Some of the states are allowing like restaurants to reopen with delivery services. And what a lot of people need to realize is they may be sticking an employee in a car who may have, they may not have, you know, vetted this driver properly, which is creating a huge negligence issue for them. Because the person has a horrible MVR record, or there's been a couple of cable companies who in the past who have hired installers who have had criminal backgrounds for rape and have actually sexually assaulted people in their homes. So, you know, when people are thinking about it, it's like, okay, I'm going to open, I'm going to deliver, or I'm going to start a delivery, they should properly vet the employees, do the background checks to make sure that they're not putting you know, their customers or clients at risk by sending an employee out with a suspended driver's license, a DWI that they may not be aware of. And they're just say, hey, you have a car you can drive, go, you know, go deliver this. So that's just kind of a word to the wise. And we had about an hour and a half webinar on that, just trying to avoid that negligent entrustment, negligent retention, supervision, and hiring aspects that are the huge torts that we're seeing in lawsuits.
No, that's excellent. That's an excellent comment, Jim. Thank you for sharing that with the group. With that, I do want to be respectful of everybody's time. I know we blocked this out for an hour. We're at the top of the hour. If maybe we can send out a survey to see how often do we want to get together? Perfect. And if
very helpful.
Go ahead, Rob.
And I know Ken mentioned every week. So this is the 4 weeks is just what came to my mind. But, you know, given how fast things are moving, I would love to get your direct feedback on what do you think an appropriate time frame is. And again, this is always adjustable. We can be nimble here. But I mean, just given how much was discussed in that hour, I think we could have gone for another one pretty easily. So I do want to be mindful of people's time, but hopefully we can expand on some of these subjects. In the past, we had one person ask about risk management software, so that's a whole other area we haven't even gotten to yet. So please remember to take advantage of this Basecamp. This Basecamp group is a great way to share in between meetings, and also can allow us to carefully construct agendas that are going to be relevant. So again, I appreciate everyone, and I'll leave it to Michael to close things out.
Yeah, sure. So real quick, Rob, it looks like in the chatter box, 2 weeks seems to be what everybody would like to get together again. I think 4 weeks may be a little bit too far out. So we will definitely plan on doing this again in 2 weeks. And then what I would ask, if there's any subjects or topics that you'd like for us to discuss as a group, please email them either to myself, Henry, or Rob, and we'll make sure that we get those on the agenda for the next meeting in a couple weeks. I do appreciate everybody's time. Once again, I always walk away from these meetings just so impressed with the intellectual capital of this group, and just the way we're all handling things in a very professional manner during a stressful time. So thank you all for joining us today, and we'll get together in 2 weeks. All right.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Stay safe.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.